$1.4 billion generated in gross merchandise value. When you are operating a product at that scale, we're talking millions and millions of users.
What are some ways for you to stay in touch with some of those users so you can know what users really, really want?
So one of the things that you usually do is...
What's your take on balancing burnout and some of those peaks in work that are always common in product management?
There's a saying, whenever you get on the plane, maybe there's an oxygen mask that will fall down, and then you need to use it for you before trying to help the others. And this is exactly what psychological sanity is about. You cannot take care of the others if you don't take care of yourself, and especially as a leader.
What is product ethics for you?
I think that we should educate our products to act just like we would like our children to act when they grow up.
This episode is brought to you by Pendo, the all-in-one product experience platform for any type of application. With Pendo, you don't need to bounce around multiple tools to uncover what's really happening inside your product. Pendo makes it easy to answer critical questions about how users are engaging with your product, then turn those insights into action. Also, you can get your users to do what you actually want them to do. First, Pendo is built around product analytics, seeing what your users actually do in your apps so you can optimize their experience. Next, Pendo lets you deploy in-app guides that lead users through their actions that matter most. Then, Pendo integrates user feedback so you can capture and analyze what people actually want. But here's the latest thing, session replays, a very cool way to visualize user sessions. Visit pendo.io/productschool to create your free Pendo account today and start building better experiences across every corner of your product. That's pendo.io/productschool.
Hey everyone, this is Carlos. I'm the CEO at Product School. And today we're here with a special guest, former Chief Product Officer at TripAdvisor. His name is Fabrice Demasri. And he started off as a three-time product entrepreneur. And then he turned into a product executive. He's someone who loves to interject humor with
good quality work.
Mixed with a dash of chance encounters, steered him into the coveted roles of product leader at three IPO companies, IBM, Deezer, and TripAdvisor. Now, he's not deep in his CPO work, and here mission to spice up the European product community. While his wife says that he's a product-holic, Fabrice answers that, as always, he's completely right. Of course, Fabrice. As a fun fact, his wife offered him a rear-sized Nimbus 2000, that's a Harry Potter's room, for his 40th birthday. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Fabrice, well, I think we should start from so many things we can cover, and I'm excited to dive into them with you. And one of the things that caught my eye was the journey that you've experienced. I've seen founders turn product people, but in your case, you did the founder thing three times. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, actually, I didn't choose it. You know, I think that just like so many people, I crashed into it. And I was at university studying law, so no links whatsoever with technology. And I was doing an internship and I saw an opportunity and thought that technology could actually solve it. And that's how I ended up being, I'd say, a product guy without even knowing that it was called products. It was back in 2002. And then, well, once I failed, actually, the first company, then I'm a bit stubborn, so I created a second one that I sold, went to work at IBM, created a third one that I sold, and went back to being a product guy, but not an entrepreneur. And that's how I ended up being there today.
So when you were the founder and not the CPO, what were the parallels that you found between just building for yourself versus building at a larger scale in another company?
And I think it goes down to ownership. One of the things that really shocked me a little bit in the last 10 years, not especially in product, but I'd say in the technological businesses, was the lack of responsibility when it comes to investments. And when you're a founder, it's your own money. So you don't just burn money. It's yours. So you just don't want to burn it. You want to use it wisely on the right things. So in a way, by being what I call a product entrepreneur, now I'm still a bit of a product entrepreneur. I think like an entrepreneur. I think like not like a mini CEO because I hate the expression, but I take responsibility in every investment I'm going to do, trying to link ROI for the company, ROI for the user. And I think I'm a better product leader because I was a product entrepreneur before.
I agree. I'm a founder at heart who loves building products. And one of the things that I'm always looking for in people in my team is to make that connection to ROI. To really treat the company as if it was there as much as possible. I understand it's just never the same, but how are you able to inspire that entrepreneurial gene into some of your members of the product?
I think because they tend to look at me as the guy who's going to make the environment great. And they think more when I start in Google as the guy who's going to talk about vision, about strategy, about the organization and operating model. Which kind of process do I have in mind? Do I do shape-up? Do I do Scrum? Do I do OKRs? And at the end, usually what I say, well, you are going to do the things. I'm not. I'm not here to be on top. I'm here to be at the bottom of the hierarchy. I'm here to support you in your decisions. So if whenever you're going to go to me and want to have my opinion on things, I will challenge you because this is your responsibility at the end to take the right decisions. You are going to take risk. You are going to fail. All I ask you to do is to fail responsibly, is to be able to explain why you decided to go there. If you go there and you fail, no problem. You give an explanation, not an excuse, an explanation. So go for it. Don't just wait for me to tell you what to do. Don't just wait for the process to tell you what to do. Just take responsibility and jump in. And usually it changes the relationship that we have. Maybe because I was a craftsman initially, because I was a product manager. I've never been executive all my life. But the fact that taking a risk is something that can be part of the process and not just an idea on the wall changes the way that they consider my role towards them.
You mentioned a couple of magic words, one of them being product strategy. And that's a key piece in ensuring that the product team is contributing to the right business outcomes, hopefully related to revenue. So what's your take on how to craft a product strategy?
Well, the first thing with strategy is that it's not being the first at something. It's not, I don't know, having this number of millions of turnover by the end of the year. This is not a strategy. This is an ambition or this is an objective. And so many people mix things. They don't understand that a strategy at heart is a story. It's you are there today. You came from another place. So you're on a trajectory. You have assets, you have liabilities, you want to go on because you have a vision, maybe in 3, 5 years, 10 years, I don't know. But you need to chapterize it. I give an example usually is The Lord of the Rings. So sorry, I'm a big geek, so I'm going to use geeky stuff as examples. But from the start of the story, you understand that the community needs to take that small ring into the Mount of Doom. Okay, that's it. So if you just tell that to the Frodo and Sam, they will get stuck and stay in the Shire because, well, it's crazy, completely crazy mission. But what actually you do is that you decide on the first chapter. That's the first book of the story. Where do you need to end up after this first chapter? And usually chapter is 1 year, 1 year and a half. So it's a destination. This is where we should be because it's desirable, because we think that by being there in 1 year, 1 year and a half, we can build that vision. It's reachable. We think we have what it needs to be able to actually do it. So that's going to be assets. It's got to be people and it's sustainable. It means that if we go there, we can have sustainable growth. And then it's really easy to explain what you're not going to do, which is really a big part of the strategy, and to ask the teams to imagine what is their missions. Because in a way, the teams are characters of the story. So is your team, it means your Frodo, your Sam, you would have to work together for 1 year and a half to go from A to B. So it's all about the story. If you make it clear, if your people can understand their role in it, then it's pretty easy to build then a roadmap, initiatives, delivery, etc. In a way, if you don't have it, you're going to crash.
One thing I've noticed or by interviewing different product executives is how easy they make it sound. And I think that's a great talent. So everybody can understand. Now, just to put things into perspective, I'm going to share some data that you share in your LinkedIn profile. 2023 results for you as a CPO at TripAdvisor. $1.4 billion generated in gross merchandise value, GMV. $154 million in revenue. That's 27% growth year over year, while reducing costs and putting the company on track to profitability in 2024 for the first time ever.
Yep.
That's pretty incredible. So the story is great, simple enough to understand. And then what is it that you do to ensure that some of those missions are actually going to lead to some of that incredible result?
There are actually two things. The first thing is that when you have people that work, I'd say, by really being really empowered. So I know that this word has been used and maybe overused, but the idea for me is to have people that can actually take responsibility over that mission. That's the first thing. It's not me giving them that mission. Second thing is linking in terms of customer outcomes, product outcomes, and business outcomes, what they're going to do with the big picture. What I use are KPI trees or product metric trees. It's my biggest artifact ever, actually, because it links what is the top business priority that we have. For example, if you take B2C, when I was working on the restaurant industry, it was LTV. Okay, that could be, I don't know, payback period, whatever. Doesn't matter. And then we found one big product KPI, which was focused on the first and second experience for my users. Because we saw that right from the beginning, if people came twice to restaurants through us, then they would come back. So they would understand really what we're doing and why it was better to actually use us instead of going directly to a restaurant or using Google Reserve, for example. So instead of putting everything that we could do on the journey, we focused on the first and second dining experience so that everything else would not be done. And then you just prioritize the work based on that because it's reachable for the teams. So the only way for me to make sure that this would be something that we would think about every day whenever they were doing their work, should they be product managers, product designers, engineers, would that they had that tree, they had this reference, whenever they were taking a decision, how would that impact that tree? Because that would even represent the impact that they would have on the other teams. So for me, it's a bit of the key thing. It's not even the roadmap. It's, okay, this is what we're aiming for. This is how you can impact. This is the levers that you have. Use it wisely. And then whenever I would challenge them, I would just recall them, remind them that this is the reference. This is what we want to achieve. And then at the end, well, it starts to be their day-to-day job, moving a needle, but not any needle, this specific needle. And it worked because they are great people.
Well, that's definitely another key part of good strategy is having a good team. And I'm trying to break this down into like the different steps. So once there's clarity around the goal, and then the team that is in charge of achieving that goal. I know you're not a big fan of OKRs. No. So I'm curious to see what alternative frameworks or way of thinking you have to track of the progress against a particular goal.
Well, it's not that I'm not a big fan of OKRs per se. I'm not a big fan of what people are doing with OKRs, just like with strategy. People tend to think that it can replace a strategy, which is not, just like the data you're looking at is not replacing the customer outcome that you want to reach. So whenever I set the goals, I set the goal based on that metric tree. I focused on what each team can actually push forward, not in terms of features, but really in terms of business results, product results, and customer results. When I say customer results, it's really based on qualitative data. So what the customer can do or could do in the future, this is what we want to enable. Products, that's going to be usage, usually, and business, that's going to be, I'd say, money at the end, or conversion, or whatever. And then they have one year left to reach that. And for me, it's enough, usually, for them to go on. They don't need to have quarterly-based objectives if they understand that this, the goal that they have to reach is in 1 year, 1 year and a half. It looks like that. If they are intelligent people, they can architecture it if need be. Being on a quarterly based for a product, if you're not in early stage, for me, it's a mistake. And I completely assume that it's maybe an unpopular opinion. And if you're a NASDAQ company, maybe you have to give results. We did at TripAdvisor. I did at IBM before, but it tends to start to be a bit, I'd say, blocking the teams from really doing their job. So standing on that, the missions, the KPI tree, usually it's enough to set up results.
And how big was your team, TripAdvisor?
65 people, just product, 300 total if you take the engineering part.
TripAdvisor is the umbrella company. Inside TripAdvisor, there are multiple brands.
For example, exactly. The Fork was the SaaS marketplace for restaurants that you led.
Yeah, exactly. And TripAdvisor is more, so TripAdvisor Group is more of an investing company. So it means that TripAdvisor.com, Viator, and The Fork are really independent companies. And TripAdvisor is really there to help us, to challenge us, just like any investor would do. But I was not, I didn't have a CPO at the group level, for example. I was reporting to the CEO directly.
So what is the connection between the different product strategies within the same holding company?
Yeah, we didn't connect. To be honest, we didn't. The businesses were very different. So we acted like partners if need be. For example, if you go through TripAdvisor.com and in the list there's a restaurant, then if there's a book with us and it's in Europe, it's going to be through The Fork. But in a way, we could have been completely different companies and just having a kind of a partnership. So we act like partners, but we don't mix product strategies.
And I know you're also big on product psychology, and that's a topic that it's also dear to my heart. Firstly, because I never studied that. I come from an engineering background. Nobody taught me anything about psychology, and something I had to kind of step onto later in my life. When you are operating a product at that scale, we're talking millions and millions of users,
what are some ways for you to stay in touch with some of those users so you can still keep a finger on the pulse and know what users really, really want?
That's a tricky question. There are two ways to do this. Of course, I'm going to say a thing that everybody knows. That's going to be, well, actually getting in contact with the users, even directly or indirectly. One of the things that usually a lot of product teams forget to do when you start to be in a big company is that they tend to forget to connect with users and then tend to forget to customer to users even through sales or customer care. They think that they know better. No. And maybe they think that it's not important because, but the user is not the user. It's 20 million, 30 million users. It's metrics. It's not real people in a way. And that becomes to be problematic. So one of the things that you usually do, and that can work with any scale of the company, is pushing the product people to spend time as customer care agents, for example, or spending time doing some shadowing with the sales or listening to the calls that they have with customers or prospects to get a grasp of a reality. For me, that's the first thing. Creating this real empathy that everybody talks about. Okay. So beyond the theory. The second thing that you do to see if things are working on is trying to make sure that beyond the metrics that you have, you think about scenarios. There's something that I fight a lot against is the happy path. So usually whenever you do, for example, a customer journey, You think about the epipath. You think about things that are logic, that people have 100% of their time to invest in your products, and there's nothing that's going to be there to disturb them. Well, how often does that happen in real life? How often do you book a restaurant while having nothing else to do? Maybe you have children that are here just playing in front of you. You're listening to, I don't know, watching a movie, or maybe you're in the transportation system, metro, whatever. And what could go wrong? So I have low bandwidth, low connection, or maybe I have someone just pushing me a message to WhatsApp. This is real life. And I try to push my teams to connect to that real life, to imagine what are all the small things that could not be the happy path. We call that stress cases. So stress cases is not edge cases. I really stress on the difference. Stress cases are imperfect situations. And how do your product recover that? And sometimes it's just thinking about it. Sometimes it's looking at the tickets from customer care to understand these stress cases. And this is how you build a digital experience that will be the perfect one in real life and not a theoretical one that you've built in your headquarters in some fancy office in the heart of Paris.
And how did you go about involving the research team to provide support but still not replace the fact that a product person has to be involved and feel the pain of the customer?
But usually what I say, that's the same thing for research or product marketing or content design, is to make sure that people understand that these are what are called product specialists. They are here to do two things. First, having a more strategical view over things. You take the fork on B2C, we had 11 teams working on the journey. And it's really hard to keep that in mind, keep the whole journey in your head. It's really, really complicated. So usually researchers would do that. They would actually show us how the journey is performing beyond pure quantitative data, I mean, in terms of qualitative data. Product marketers will show us the competition and how the others are addressing it. Content design would tell us which kind of feeling that we actually are pushing through the words that we are using. So they would give us a more complete view over the journey, but not replace what you would do as a team. The second thing is enablement, making sure that actually, if you need to do UX research, you have everything you need to do that, I'd say, within a snap. That's it. Because one of the things, I'd say the most problematic things that I see with product teams is that they won't do discovery, but they don't because it's too hard, too expensive, too long, or it seems too complicated to set up. So at the end, they say, yeah, it's going to slow me down. And if I need 3 weeks to do discovery, well, better not do it and go on with what I have. So for me, it's really that. The role of this box specialist within the company is strategy and enablement, not doing that, replacing the teams.
I think that in startups, that's not even an option because the product person is wearing all the hats. And there is some value in that, right? The luxury of your impact through a product marketing team. And I appreciate people that have that sense of scrappiness. At the same time, I can recognize the challenge at a larger scale when you have that opportunity and it's good, they're adding value. However, it cannot be a full replacement of the role of PM. It's also doing discovery. It's also doing go-to-market. It's also doing sales. And otherwise, you are just a glorified project manager coordinating other people doing their work.
Definitely. And there's one thing. There's sometimes a lack of humidity. Well, people don't leverage the proxy information that they have. So you know that, of course, customer care or sales or the trainer will always be biased because they are not product people. Just like you would be biased if you have to sell something because you're not the salespeople. That's by definition it. And I sometimes hear teams saying, yeah, we need to do user research and start from scratch instead of building on that proxy information and say, yeah, it's proxy. So maybe the confidence that I can get from that is 60, 70%. So I need to get this extra 30%. And that should be enough for me to have a complete view of our situation. So sometimes this humility is lacking, maybe because they read sometimes too many books that's going to say you need to do user research for weeks and weeks and weeks, do design thinking, etc. But it's not what the books are saying. The books are saying that you need to use your time wisely and need in the information that you have at your disposal is where you start and not replace it from scratch.
Well, let's talk about it because the list of potential things to do for a PM are unlimited. The backlog is never empty. And I heard you talk about, even in your intro, your wife calls you a product holic. So I can imagine that you're able to take high loads of work. It's important to navigate the balance with other things that are going on in your life, as well as the team morale, make sure that people don't break and everybody's able to accomplish that mission. So we can go into the next one. So what's your take on balancing burnout and some of those peaks in work that are always common in product management?
Well, I'm not a good example on that. Not with my teams, because I tend to always consider appetite and ambition and tell them that they're going to do more because they're going to break. And one of the things that people don't understand with burnout is not weakness. It's tracks that you pushed too far. And that's really what it is. Usually people burning out are people committed, involved, people that are going to do the extra mile. And this is because they've done too many extra miles that they break. So one of the things that I try to do personally with my personal life is try not to work on weekends. So we'll say, okay, but does it mean that you work at 10, 11 p.m.? Yes, sometimes I do. Sometimes I send messages at 11 p.m. on Slack. I'm trying to learn to, you know, to say that send it tomorrow at 9 a.m. And I'm not expecting my teams to answer ever. And whenever they answer, I actually yell at them, say, I don't want you to answer at 11 p.m. Yeah, boss, you sent it. Yes, I know. But yeah, I had two personal experience with burnout. My wife is a psychologist and she went through a burnout. So even as a psychologist, even knowing all the things at stake, she actually got burnt out. And it took us, I'd say, 1 year and a half to go through it together. Okay. I had two people in my teams doing burnouts. One, because she was pushing a situation when she didn't have the competency to do it. And that was before my time. So I inherited from that situation. And it's not her fault. She was pushing the situation. She was stretched too thin. And I tried to sell the situation. I tried to put her back in the success mode. But it was too far. She was already broken. And I deeply regret that we put someone in that situation. Another one, which is a friend of mine, was not my manager directly, but pushed a lot for change. And he didn't really receive support from his boss. And that started to be problematic. Because when your boss is a people pleaser, and you are in a situation where you want to change things, and it's pretty common when it comes to product, let's face that, we tend to push for changes. If you let, let's say, your teams not alone, but they don't feel like you're going to be there to defend, well, he just burned out because he was so busy doing this on top of his job as head of. So I saw the signs. I was really careful about it. I was really disappointed that it happened, even if I sent messages to his boss. And at the end, I don't think his boss even feels responsible of the situation. So I guess it's our responsibility as leaders, it's our responsibility as colleagues to look for people that seem, I'd say sometimes, angry at the situation. And one of the things that I saw, which was really even, it was anger or despair. That was the biggest weak signals of people that was going to go in the burnout. despair because they thought that whatever they were doing was not working, and anger because usually they didn't feel supported or helped.
I think just talking about it is already helping people realize that it also happens at all levels and that it happens multiple times and that it's not a joke.
I burnt out a few times.
And I think I'm much better at diagnosing when someone is about to go in that stage versus doing it for myself. So I constantly need for people that I know care about me to keep me accountable and then even use technology. I recently bought this wristband that I've been using, you know, like the rings as well, a different like Apple Watch has some more metrics to just make me more aware of my quality of sleep, right? Like my stress levels and like how much I exercise. So I think it also comes with probably age and other responsibilities in life. If someone starts having a family and whatnot, you are forced to prioritize. You've been burnt out before. You know it's not fun. So I wonder if there's any type of system or other types of ways for you to keep yourself accountable and hopefully help other people on your team do the same.
Well, I really like what you just said, having people around you. There's a saying in the, whenever you get on the plane, then say that maybe there's an oxygen mask that will fall down and then you need to use it for you before trying to help the others. And this is exactly what I'd say psychological sanity is about. You cannot take care of the others if you don't take care of yourself, and especially as a leader. One of the things that I've seen that helped me a lot is meditation. And I consistently, that's my wife pushed me to do meditation. My idea of meditation was really, let's say, okay, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not really into religion, whatever. So it really, I was just laughing at it. And just doing that, mindfulness really, it helped me just focus on the things that were important, which was not the big things that I was doing, not even the results or the conferences. It was just what was happening in front of me right now. I started to eat differently even, trying just to go back to eating while focusing on whatever I was feeling, what I was tasting. And I tended to, I'm French, so I'm supposed to love food. Okay. That's in our DNA. But, my wife told me, you don't see how quick you eat. You eat like that. It doesn't look like you're taking pleasure in eating. So for me, that was a big change, trying to do meditation every morning, whenever I was taking the train to go to in the center of Paris. 20 minutes, that's really short, okay? But it was enough just for me to focus. And every time at lunch, I would focus. And I would just get a bit magically, to be honest, allowing me to say, okay, are these things really that important? And, well, if it fails, okay, imagine it fails. What will happen? What is the worst thing that could happen, really? And I started thinking like this, what is the worst thing that could really happen? We're not saving lives, and so some people are saying, but yeah, 4 years, that's real. We're not saving lives. And is there one customer which is angry at it? Okay. Do we actually arm this business so deeply that he has to stop and close his restaurants? No. Okay. So let's take a step back, because the anxiousness that you're feeling, it's just in your imagination. It's not real. So it helped me a lot, and I tend to push people to do the same. And it works. So it's not magic. It's not magic. I mean, it looks like magic, to be honest. But that's the only way I found as a leader to be able to focus on the real things.
I like what you said about putting your mask on first. So, because taking care of yourself, in a way, the impact that you have now, we have now as leaders, is just much bigger than what we can do with our own hands. And that also leads by example. So, come across someone thoughtful, that cares about the team, cares about the mission, and cares about the how the team is going to be able to accomplish that mission. So I would like to continue exploring some of those hot topics that are not typically talked about, at least in product. One is product ethics, which is doing the right thing by people involved, not just making money at all costs. And I know you're a big advocate of that. So maybe we can start by defining what is product ethics for you?
Well, I tend to talk about responsibility. I'm going to explain you why. For me, doing responsible product is not being an NGO. It's not trying to create a positive social impact, for example. It's about limiting the harm. Okay? It's not about saying I'm not going to do profit. It's about making profit, but not harming the people at the right time. So there are really three parts of it. This really, are you going to harm the environment and limit the footprint that you have on environment, limit the footprint that you have on people, because whatever you say, you could say, I don't know if you know that excuse from the NRA, so the National Rifle Association and the US, whenever there's a mass shooting, they say, you know, it's not the weapons that kill, it's the people. So we're not responsible because we're pushing the weapons. Well, we don't care about that. I don't care about that. Who is responsible or who can have a lever on limiting the harm of products? It's product people. There we go. So I don't care who's responsible. It's not the user that can do something. It's you. So it's the same thing on people. And the third is about the economy. It's usually something that is not radically considered, but so many companies are harming their providers. They are harming even competition. Amazon did that. Booking is doing that. Taking 30% from hotels. Yeah, because you can do it. Is it right? I don't think so. I think we make into even the folk sometimes think that you're taking a fee which is too high because people depend on you. So just like when you have people depending on you, your parents, your sister, your mother, your daughter, you may have your parents sometimes that depend on you. Are you taking advantage of them? Well, if you do that, you're not responsible. You're a very, very bad human being. So I think that we should, in a way, educate our products to act just like we would like our children to act when they grow up, being responsible towards the planet, towards the people, and toward the economy, toward the people that are going to work with. This is really what, for me, product responsibility, product ethics are about.
When I hear you talk about product ethics, I what comes to mind is trust. Because as someone who cares about building something for the long term, I want to, and my customers trust me. And you are building something like that, with that in mind, and not just trying to squeeze in the last dollar in the first interaction, that ultimately can bring you better returns. But I think it takes a longer-term mindset to truly care about investing in a relationship without expecting everything in return right away.
Yeah. I mean, just like you do with human beings, you're the perfect example with what you're building with Product School, is that you don't have an immediate return. When you go through a course, it takes some time to think about it, to encounter things. But say, hey, yeah, I remember that course I took two years ago. And actually, I'm in that situation. So when you're building on yourself, you're building on long terms. You just don't take a job for the next 3 months. You usually try to take a job for 2, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. I don't know, because you're building a career. So you always think about the short and the long term. Sometimes you will accept a salary that not going to be that high, but because you think this company is going to grow. And this is why you join a startup usually. You think, okay, maybe there's an exit sometime. I'm going to be rich and independent and do whatever I want. We tend not to do that when we build products and sometimes we build companies. Even now, we're talking about profitability, but people think in terms of short-term profitability, not in terms of sustainability. And we need to build sustainable growth. So sustainable goals is just like you say, not by making, I'd say, using our power against the users and against the ecosystem. It's by making sure that people want to be part of the people that work with you. And then you're creating value for the ecosystem and not just punctioning it for your own sake.
I think Jeff Bezos has this clip on YouTube where he talks about the difference between missionaries and mercenaries, and how when he's hiring, he's always prioritizing the missionaries, the ones who are not going to leave you hanging just because there is someone else paying a little bit more. And I find that fascinating. And I think especially in businesses that are mission driven, it's so important to remind the team of the mission and use it as a pre-qualifier. So it's important for people not just to say, well, I'm mission driven, but truly care about the mission. So you know that if you're really trying to build trust with your customers, you also have trust with your team first.
No, but so many people will, and I encompass leaders and sometimes even founders, they tend to not be completely honest about what they want to build. And sometimes they just want to get rich, and that's okay. It's a mission. We're trying to invent a mission for the company that put that on slides because we want to make the world a better place. I remember one episode from the Silicon Valley show when there's startups that are pitching, and they are all the startups are pitching that's going to take the world from where it is to a better place. And it starts to be funny, you know? And I've seen so many companies that invent mission from scratch. They try to justify, and then they tell to the employees, you need to be mission driven. Yeah, but your mission is crap. It's not real. So it needs to be authentic. That's the only thing that I'd say, is that if you want people to believe in your mission, make it authentic, and then you can use it as a criteria. Else, you're just a wonderful business liar, and plenty of business liars became rich. I have no problem with that, but this is another game.
Fabrice, one of the things related to this that I know it's important for you is to build community. You're French and you're based in Europe, and now you've been contributing to the product community for a long time. So first of all, curious to know, what are some of the differences that you've seen in the European product community in Europe in general versus the product community in the US?
Well, it's hard to have a common rule, to be honest, because when you take Europe, there are many, many different realities. If you take the UK, and let's assume that UK is in Europe, because, you know, sometimes the UK, it's always a bit difficult, but the UK is really resembling the US. And to be honest, when we created the product community in France, all of us had an experience in the UK and the US. And it was coming from one company that you know of, and I'm not going to quote them, that conferences in London, and they were doing meetups. So we just created a meetup in Paris using that brand at the beginning. And in France at that moment, there was absolutely nothing. When you take a look now, France is pretty advanced. Germany is too. The Netherlands is very, very keen on growth, more even than products. Spain starting to be. Portugal starting. Italy starting. Poland, Greece really starting. So it's really not homogeneous in terms of community. Now, the second thing, I think the second biggest difference is the importance of capitals. When you say Paris, for example, it represents maybe 85 or 90% of the product people are in Paris, which you couldn't have in the US, because by definition, you have people on the West Coast, people on the East Coast, people in Texas. So you don't have one capital that's going to be so important. Take a look at Germany. You have Hamburg, you have Berlin, because their history based on regions, Landers. Same thing in Spain. You have Madrid and Barcelona. So different hubs. So it's you need to adapt to that reality. You cannot just copy paste whatever you're going to take on the US and the UK. The last thing, for me, the big difference is we tend not to be that involved in communities when we go to school. Okay, we don't have fraternities. We don't have this importance of the network. We don't learn how to network. So it means that whenever you start a community, it's not going to be easy. Some people don't even understand why they should be part of the community right at the beginning. It's not in their DNA. So it slowed down a little bit the growth of the community compared to the US, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm from Spain, living in San Francisco. And when I started product school, this is around 10 years ago, I started with a community first and foremost. So I'm aware of some of the cultural differences. And I agree with what you said, because San Francisco, even though 10 years ago, there wasn't as much demand for product manager roles as there is today, there was a higher sense of awareness. Like definitely, at least at the startup level, like all many founders would call themselves product people. They would do the product job. We would see some high-tech companies like Google, Meta, Uber. They already had product managers. They were paving the way. Maybe that wasn't mainstream enough yet for companies outside the Silicon Valley hub or New York hubs, outside high tech, to start considering hiring product managers at scale. But it was getting started. And now that it's been 10 years in, and clearly I can acknowledge how mainstream this is. Like, I believe obviously that this is probably the best time in history to be in product, given the amount of companies that invest in technology, they have product managers and whatnot. But in Europe, has been happening for some time. And I think about this business school concept, the S-curve of the product, where they show the maturity, right? And how I would probably say Silicon Valley started earlier, so it's more mature. However, I'm seeing more parts of Europe and other parts in the world that are getting to that shape. So I'm bullish, and I want to believe that as companies become more digital, there is going to be an even higher product, and the relevance of these type of communities, either at a local or global level, is going to be even more important.
I agree with you.
And switching gears, I also want to discuss org design, because I know you are a big thinker, and sometimes there is no perfect. This is the same way there's no perfect answer for how to go about strategy. I noticed in your LinkedIn profile that your team, you oversaw not only product managers, but designers and marketers, content designers, SEO experts. That seems pretty unique to me. So curious to know what was behind involving some of those marketers as part of the product org.
If you go back to OKRs and why they were designed and why people want to use it, it's about alignment, really. And when you are a product company, there's one thing that is supposed to align everyone. It's product. Okay. So whenever you have people in marketing that are having their teams divided but functional specialties, you're harming the ability to align. So I'm working in the CRM team on acquisition. Okay. What happens if the priority of the company in terms of product is not acquisition, but retention? Would you change your job? No, usually they don't. They'll stay in their fields. So they are disconnected from what is the priority of the company. Try to get them closer to the teams, trying to imagine how they could actually not just reach objective in terms of click-through campaigns, whatever, but how can I actually take part of the story, the chapter that we're going to build right now in product changes deeply the things. If I take the SEO, for example, SEO, everybody wants to be good SEO. We were, and we still are good in SEO at the fork. If you look for a restaurant in Paris, the first page is never going to be the page of that restaurant. It's going to be the fork. Okay. So you can be proud of that. Now, where does that lead you? Does that lead you to just booking? And that's it. You're not even conscious that you're booking on the fork. So in a way, is it really a product, or is it just, let's say, an answer you're looking for and you don't care which brand is going to be behind that? So when we talked with the SEO experts and embedded that within our teams, it was to consider how could we make that as a channel to actually make people understand that beyond booking, there was review, there was intelligence, there was virality that they could use through the app. So trying to change the way that we were considering how SEO was defining success. It was not in terms of number of people that's going to click on it. It's the number of people that are going to understand what is the advantage of using the thought against Google Reserve. So I think it was completely different. If this team had been in the marketing part, they would think only in terms of SEO per se, and not in terms of experience and not in terms of brand. So for me, that's one of the biggest things that I loved in my job, was being able to have people really have a lever in making sure that the product strategy would become reality, even if they were not product people.
That connects very much with what I'm seeing in other companies where product used to be a sub-function of technology. There used to be like an officer. In many cases, it was a sub-function of business. There would be a kind of chief marketing officer. Now we're seeing people like you, chief product officers, who are at the table, who are reporting to the CEO, who are really connecting the technology and business to make sure that this is actually good ROI and a good experience for the user. So I'm very bullish on that path as well, to see not only more companies hiring PMs, but also more structured career ladders where the product teams have a dedicated function and are truly allowed to make an impact.
And one of the things which is hard to get for, I think, plenty of companies, and that's only part of this, okay? And that's very biased, I guess, but we are the only ones in the company that will have interdisciplinary teams that can have the same objective. Product manager, product designers, product engineers, for example. Usually you don't have that when you have sales and marketing and customer care. It doesn't exist in a way. We are at heart have this ability to look for objectives and common objectives. We have this ability to transform our organization based on the strategy. Because every one year and a half, you can redispatch your forces on different levers because you have a new chapter ahead of you. This is pretty unique compared to all the other functions of a company. So either you place it in an IT department and consider that you silo it, or you use it as the biggest lever that you could get and saying that being product-led is not having product manager telling you what to do, but having product teams on the forefront, in the trenches, doing whatever we need to make business grow, and the other functions helping them being good at what they do. And that's going to be marketing, sales, support, etc. So it's not hierarchical. I don't know. It's not about hierarchy. Sorry, I'm French. But it's really about concentrating our forces, and thinking that the people in the trenches are the product people, help them be at their best, give them insights, give them information, give them access to customers, create campaigns based on that, help them test, help them go to market and go to the customer. This is the best thing you could do as sales or marketing or support, is helping the product teams perform.
Fabrice, it's been a pleasure to have this opportunity to learn more about how you think about strategy, org design, product psychology, ethics, community building, and many other things. I was very grateful to have you on our stage as a speaker at ProductCon London. I know you're very active in general. So for anyone interested in learning more about product and product, what is the best way to find about you?
LinkedIn is a perfect way. Don't hesitate to ping me. I absolutely love to have discussion about products and then to help founders whenever I can. I've always been an advisor, even when I was a CPO, and I still love to be to have problematics on markets that I don't know anything about. They call that curiosity, and I don't think it's a sickness. I think it's a blessing.
Thank you so much for your time. Talk soon.
There you go, Carlos. Bye-bye.